that you think her name is pretty. She'll love hearing that. He rolled his eyes as if it were too silly for words. And, of course, just to be fair and equal, I have to tell you that my son has a nice name as well. Claire laughed. I'm sure he does. The nurturer started off slowly on the bicycle. Behind him, strapped into the little seat, his mouth speckled with leaf fragments, the infant looked back and grinned at Claire. It's Jonas, the man called, referring to his son, and pedaled away toward the group of dwellings where he lived. Chapter 13. She arranged her days so that she would see them often, the man and the infant on the back of his bicycle. She became accustomed to the times, morning and evening, when the two of them made the short journey to and from the nurturing center, and she took walks then, after breakfast and before the evening meal. Often she encountered them, and usually the man stopped to chat, though sometimes he was rushed and had to hurry on. Little Abe, though she carefully referred to him as 36, knew her now, and grinned when he saw her. The man had taught him to wave his small hand when she said bye-bye, and they rode on. It became something to look forward to, a pleasant interruption to the long hours of lab work, which held little interest for Claire. He imitated her. She poked her own tongue into her cheek, making a bump. He stared at it, then pushed his own small tongue into his own cheek. She wrinkled her nose, so did he. Then she did the two things together, her tongue into her cheek, her nose scrunched. Solemnly, he did the same, and they both began to laugh. He was growing, though he was technically now simply a one. Every new child born this year had become a one at the ceremony. She calculated the months from the day of his birth. It had been now 10 months. He's trying to walk, the nurturer told her one morning. He's strong, she said, gazing at the sturdy small legs dangling from the child seat on the back of the bike. Yes, we hold his hands and he takes steps. One day soon he'll be on his own. My spouse will have to put things high up on the counters. He grabs at everything. You have to be careful, Claire said, almost talking to herself, thinking about how difficult it must be to care for an infant. Of course, that was part of my training, the nurturer explained reassuringly. And I've taught my spouse and children. Hey, he said, suddenly laughing. He turned. The new child was tugging its uniform. Don't mess me all up. This was just delivered from the laundry. He turned to Claire. Could you reach into that carrying case and get his hippo? He pointed to a zippered case behind the child seat. His what? Claire pulled the zipper open. His comfort object. It's called Hippo. Oh. She reached in and took out the stuffed toy. All small children had comfort objects. They came in various shapes. Hers, she remembered, had been called Badger. The new child's eyes lit up when he saw it. Po! He said and reached for the toy. Claire handed it to him. He hugged it with a satisfied sigh and began to chew on one of its small ears. I think they might be ready to have you stop by and help again, the nurturer suggested. We have a batch of new ones. And the little ones take my time, he added. You could come play with 36 and keep him out of mischief. I will. She waved when they rode on and called, bye-bye. But the new child was preoccupied with his hippo and didn't even hear her. She saw Marie for the first time. The cargo boat had come and gone now 3 times since the day she had met and talked to its crew member. Each month it arrived and remained at dock only a day, long enough for the unloading. She recognized the boy she had walked with once, and waved when she saw him on the deck. He waved back. Claire almost felt that if he repeated his invitation for a tour, she would say yes, though she would ask permission first, she decided. She would check with the hatchery director. But they came and went so quickly that the boy... Odd, she thought of him as her friend, though in truth they had shared only one brief conversation. Did not come ashore. And now they were moored again, but she didn't see him. Other crew members scrambled about, tending lines, lifting crates, but the dark-haired boy wasn't there. Claire glanced over at the activity on the boat through the windows of the lab from time to time, and it became clear that he was no longer part of the crew. She mentioned it to her co-worker, Heather, phrasing it carefully. There used to be a dark-haired boy who worked on the boat, but... Lots of dark-haired boys. Look, there are 3 right there, piling those crates. Heather was correct. Three muscular young men were lifting and straightening some heavy boxes. Each had dark hair.
Yes, but I meant a different one, one who used to wave to me. He and I talked once.
Heather shrugged.
They come and go. Different ones almost every time. Some stay a while, others not so much. It's not like here, where we get assigned. I think they can decide about their jobs. If it gets boring, they leave, or maybe something better comes along.
Look! Who's that? Claire pointed. A heavy woman had come from the interior of the boat and stood on the deck, watching the crew at work. She wore a stained apron stretched across her wide middle and tied in back. Her light hair was pulled back into a knot, but it was unruly, and as the girls watched, the woman smoothed and retied it. Then she lowered herself and sat on a thick pile of rope, leaning back against the cabin wall, and took a few deep breaths.
"Mind your feet, Marie," a crew member called, as he passed her on the deck, guiding a thick package that swayed in a net as the winch moved it up and outward.
"Mind your own feet," she called back with a hearty laugh, but she moved her legs aside so that he could get by.
"The boy told me there was a woman aboard," Claire said. "I'd forgotten her name, but now I remember it's Marie. She's the cook."
"Cook?" Heather looked puzzled. Claire shrugged. "Well, they can't have their meals delivered the way we do. Not when they're on the river."
"Or the sea," she added in her mind. "So I guess Marie prepares the food."
"Her apron has its share of it," Heather said, referring to the darkened, spattered patches on the cloth, and she and Claire both laughed. Their own uniforms were spotless. Their clothing was collected every morning, laundered meticulously, and delivered each evening.
"Would you go aboard if they invited you?" Claire asked Heather, "just for a tour."
"You mean like when people come to visit the hatchery and we show them around?"
Claire nodded. Often, small school groups came to visit and were given a little lesson on the life cycle of fish.
"I might if it's allowed," Heather said with a shrug, "but I'm not really that interested in boats."
They watched as Marie rose heavily from where she had been relaxing, re-entered the cabin, and disappeared into the dark interior. Claire found herself wondering what it looked like in there. Where did Marie sleep? And how did it feel to be on the river, to stop at other communities? Did people everywhere look the same? The boy she had met wore strange-looking shoes and unfamiliar clothing. He had a different speech inflection, she recalled, and the different hairstyles on the boys was startling. Some had almost clean-shaven heads, others long hair tied back like a girl's. Here in the community, each age had a prescribed hairstyle, but no boy ever had long hair. Marie, with her oddly light hair, was startling in other ways. She was large, especially broad across her hips, and with a double chin. No one in the community looked like that. They were all of the same proportions. Their food delivery was calibrated to their size. Claire remembered a time some years ago when the weekly report showed that her mother's weight had risen slightly. Her mother had been a little embarrassed and perhaps annoyed when the next meal deliveries included special weight loss meals designated for her. She had eaten them, of course, it was required, and there were no alternatives, until the report showed that her size was under control once again.
"We'd better get back to work," Heather murmured.
She turned from the window.
"I'm just going out for a minute. I want to check the temperature in the lower holding pond."
Claire could see Heather frown suspiciously.
"Well," Heather said after a moment,
"mind your feet. It's muddy by the pond."
"Mind your own feet,"
Claire replied with a laugh as she left the room. She had no intention of going aboard, even if they asked her, but the lower pond was quite close to the river. The boat almost grazed the bank there, and she felt a yearning to go close to it. Odd, she thought, but she felt almost lured by the boat, in the same way that she had found herself drawn to the nurturing center and the new child who had been wrested from her body almost a year before. There was no relationship between the two, but Claire was feeling increasingly connected to both. Standing beside the pond's edge, she looked up at the vessel's smooth side, toward the low railing that edged the deck.
The huge crates were all stacked now and tightly roped in. There were places near the cargo where there was no railing. How easy it would be to slip on the wet deck and fall into the river below. "Mind your feet." She remembered the young man's shoes with their ridged soles. Boat shoes, she had guessed, made specially for the wet deck. Claire was still standing there when the boat's engine made a sudden low sound. In a moment it was a steady hum and she could see a spurt of dark smoke from a small stack. Some voices called, and she saw a crew member pull loops of rope loose from the moorings. He tossed them to another young man on the deck and then jumped across and steadied himself as the boat slid away toward the center of the river. From the building nearby, she heard the buzzer that announced the midday meal. She turned and walked back toward the hatchery, as behind her the cargo boat moved with increasing speed toward the bridge and beyond. Behind it, at its broad stern, foam burst. Then the river closed around the interruption and resumed its own form again, as if the boat had never been there. Claire sighed. Returning to her ordinary life seemed so unappealing. She would go tomorrow, she decided, to visit little Abe.
Chapter 14. On the 12-month anniversary of the day he had been born to her, Claire taught him to say her name. He had been officially a one since the previous ceremony, but now, Claire thought secretly, he is truly 1 year old. The nurturer chuckled when he watched the new child toddle over to her, calling, "Claire!" with a grin.
"He's a bright boy," he said. "I just wish we could get his sleeping pattern behavior squared away. If he's not ready to be placed with a family unit by the time of the next ceremony, well..."
"What?"
Claire asked when his voice drifted away without completing the thought.
"To be honest, I don't know. They can't give him to parents if he doesn't sleep. It would interrupt their work habits to be kept awake at night. But we can't keep him here indefinitely."
"Not even if he goes home with you at night? He's fine here in the daytime. He hardly ever cries. Look at him."
Together they gazed at 36, who was seated on the floor, busily arranging wooden blocks in a stack. Feeling their gaze, he looked over. Impishly, he wrinkled his nose and thrust his tongue into his cheek, making the funny face that Claire had taught him. She made the same skewed face in reply, and they both laughed.
"I can't keep taking him home forever. My spouse is already somewhat annoyed by it. The children enjoy him, though. He's been sleeping in my son's room. He seems to do well there, but..."
Again, he failed to finish his thought. The nurturer shrugged and went to the other section of the room where younger infants needed attention.
"I wonder if I..."
Claire murmured, then fell silent. Of course she couldn't. Unmatched people weren't given new children. Even if it were possible, how could she care for him? It was enough to contemplate, and she had, how she could manage a small infant. But now, so well acquainted with this growing, active 12-month-old boy, she could see clearly that they required more, not less, care as they grew. He had to be watched constantly, taught language, fed carefully, bathed and dressed, and...
She turned away, feeling tears well in her eyes. What on earth was the matter with her?
No one else seemed to feel this kind of passionate attachment to other humans. Not to a new child, not to a spouse or a co-worker or friend. She had not felt it toward her own parents or brother. But now, toward this wobbly, drooling toddler.
"Bye-bye," she whispered to him, and he looked up at her and wiggled his fingers. It never distressed him when she left. He knew she'd be back. But Claire choked back tears as she pedaled her bike back to the hatchery. More and more she despised her life. The dull routine of the job, the mindless conversation with her co-workers, the endless repetition of her days. She wanted only to be with the child, to feel the warm softness of his neck as he curled against her, to whisper to him, and to sense how he listened happily to her voice. It was not right to have these feelings, which were growing stronger as the weeks passed. Not normal, not permitted, she knew that. But she did not know how to make them go away. From time to time, she saw the nurturer's son. Jonas, she remembered. Months before, she had seen his father wave to him one afternoon when he rode by with a friend, the two of them on their way apparently to the recreation field. The two boys had seemed carefree, calling to each other, racing their bicycles along the path. He seemed different now to Claire. She saw him one evening walking along the river, alone, deep in thought. Although he didn't know her, and there would have been no real reason beyond politeness for a greeting, it was nonetheless customary for citizens to acknowledge one another with a nod or a smile. But Jonas had not looked up as she passed him. It was not an intentional snub, she realized. It was that his mind was somewhere else. He seemed somehow troubled, she thought, and that was rare in a youngster. She recalled that he had been singled out in some way at last year's ceremony. Her co-workers, in describing it, had chanted his name, Jonas, Jonas, as apparently the audience had. But they had not really known what his, what had they called it? Selection, that was it, what his selection had meant. But his father, the nurturer, spoke of him warmly and without hesitation. He's been sleeping in my son's room, he had said cheerfully of 36. So perhaps she had simply happened on the boy at an unusual moment when he had something on his mind. Probably a school assignment. Claire could remember how troubling her own homework had been at times.
She saw him several times more, always on his bicycle, alone, after school hours. He was a 12 now, and all 12s would be working hard this year on the preparation related to their assignments. Usually after school, they would separate from their age mates and go to the studies required for their future jobs. Sophia had been required to take infant care classes, she recalled, and in fact, Sophia had told her that even now, several years after their ceremony year, the scholarly Marcus was still studying engineering. One girl in her group had taken up the study of law, as Claire's brother had 6 years earlier, and still went each day after school to the Hall of Law and Justice for training. One afternoon, she found herself watching Jonas as he rode his bicycle away from the school building, which she could see from the front of the hatchery. He turned left at the end of the educational buildings and seemed to be heading toward the House of the Old. So perhaps, she thought, that was his assignment, the care of the elderly. But what was so special about that? What would make an entire audience rise to their feet and chant his name? Later, one day while walking, she continued past the House of the Old, turned down a path, and discovered a very small structure attached to the rear of the building. It had a door, a few windows, and nothing else. Most buildings had an informational plaque explaining the purpose of the structure. Hatchery laboratory, nurturing center, bicycle repair. But this undistinguished rectangle had only an unobtrusive, meaningless label on the door. Annex. Claire had never heard of the annex. She had no idea what could be housed inside. But she had a feeling that this was where the boy Jonas was spending his training time. She wondered vaguely if what was happening in there was causing him to become so oddly solemn and solitary. What could Jonas have been selected for? Chapter 15. Claire looked around suddenly at her co-workers during the morning meal. Ever since her arrival at the hatchery over a year earlier, she had felt different from them. They didn't seem to notice. They were friendly enough and included her in their outings. Everyone was fond of the director, Dimitri, who never allowed his position of authority to make him arrogant. They were able to tease him about his long wait for a spouse. But those who were young, as Claire was, shared small jokes, sometimes slightly derisive, of the older workers, how methodical and orderly they were, how dutifully they went home each evening to their spouses and family units. Of course, they were all diligent workers as well. But youth was a time when a certain amount of lightheartedness was tolerated. Standing on the edge of the holding ponds, they gave the young fish silly names and invented personalities for them. Look at greedy Gus, he's grabbing all the food again. Watch out, here comes Big Lips Buster. Claire always smiled at the foolishness. The vessels, during her time at the birthing unit, had done the same thing, found things to joke about, ways to pass the time. She had joined in, she had been part of it, and of them, until the end. But here, she had always felt separate, different. It was hard to identify why. But today, at breakfast, she suddenly noticed something that she had taken for granted until now. As they cleared their plates, tossed their crumpled napkins into the waste container, and smoothed their uniforms in preparation for another day of work, each worker did one other routine quick thing. They each took a pill. Claire knew about the pills. The pill taking in the community began at about 12, or for some children, earlier. Parents observed their children and decided when the time had come. She herself had not been deemed ready for the pills before her ceremony of 12. It hadn't mattered to her. Those of her friends who took them found it a nuisance. But when she was selected birth mother at the ceremony, part of her list of instructions had specified, "No pills. If you are already taking the pills, stop immediately. If you have not yet begun, do not begin." She remembered now that the pill prohibition had seemed unimportant at the time. Her parents, though, were a little flustered by it. They took the pills. So did her brother, Peter. "I had them here ready for you when the time came," Claire's mother had said with a nervous laugh. "I suppose I'll just throw them away." "Better turn them in," her father had suggested. She had asked the other vessels when she had taken up residence at the birthing unit. "Were you already taking the pills?" Claire inquired at mealtime one evening. Some had shrugged and said no, but several nodded. "I stopped right away when I got my instructions," one girl said. "I sort of tapered off," another girl explained. "I think it's because we got switched over to vitamins," Nadia had said. She was referring to the carefully measured dosages of vitamins that all the vessels dutifully took each morning. "The pills were probably just a different vitamin that we don't need anymore." "No, the pill was something else entirely," Suzanne insisted. She was the one who said she had tapered off. "She's right," Miriam said. "The vitamins don't make us feel any different, but the pill?" She hesitated. "Well, taking it didn't seem to have any effect, but when I stopped taking it, I began to feel..." But she couldn't seem to describe what she meant. "I felt restless," Suzanne explained, "and, well, this is a little embarrassing. I don't even know how to describe it, but I began to be aware of my own feelings. Not just in my head, but, well, physical feelings, too." She blushed and chuckled nervously. The other girls, including Claire, felt embarrassed, too, but intrigued. Feelings of any sort were not ordinarily discussed. "Yes, that's it," Miriam agreed. "And you know what? I think they want us to undergo that change. Without the pills, our body gets ready. That's what we're experiencing." "I kind of like it. I never really wanted anything before, but now I want the product. When I feel it growing, it makes me happy." She rubbed her belly and smiled. The other girls agreed, touching their own distended middles. "It's a nice feeling." "After you give birth, you take the pills again until you're ready for the next time," Nancy had said. She had produced 3 products by then and was waiting for her post-birth mother assignment. "How long? This is my first time," Claire had asked. "I never had the pills at all." "You will, though. After you produce, you'll take the pills. Maybe 6 months. Then you stop and you get ready for your next product. See Karen over there?" She pointed to a young woman at a nearby table. "She just produced. She's on the pills now, but in a few months, she'll need to start getting ready for her second production." "It's really boring," Suzanne said in a whisper. "When you're between births and taking the pills, nothing is much fun. You don't really notice it, though." Now, looking around in the hatchery cafeteria, Claire was aware that all the other workers took a pill every morning, and that was why, she realized, their conversation was always lighthearted, superficial, essentially meaningless. They were like the vessels in the pill-taking time between births, without feeling. She was the only one, she could see now, who did not take a pill each day, and she guessed that it was simply a mistake. Her disastrous birth experience and her decertification had been so sudden and startling, that no one at the birthing unit had thought to supply her with pills or instruct her to take them. Perhaps each attendant had thought that someone else had done so. And so, she was the one who felt things, the only one. It was why she yearned for the child, and felt her heart melt each time his little hand waved and he said bye-bye to her, calling out her name in his silvery voice, smiling that amazing smile. She would not let them take that from her, that feeling. If someone in authority noticed that error, if they delivered a supply of pills to her, she thought defiantly, she would pretend. She would cheat. But she would never, under any circumstances, stifle the feeling she had discovered. She would die, Claire realized, before she would give up the love she felt for her son.
Chapter 16. The supply boat was once again moored by the hatchery. Its ropes had been looped over the posts and its slanted gangplank slid ashore. Recalling the delay they had suffered a year ago, this time they had arrived early and would be leaving before the coming two-day event prevented their departure. The time of the ceremony was fast approaching. Had it really been that long? Had she been here at the hatchery for well over a year? It was hard to believe. But when she thought of the child, of little Abe, she was aware of how he had developed from an infant wailing for a bottle when she first encountered him, into a giggly toddler who could say her name, wave bye-bye, and imitate the funny face they now made to each other as a greeting that made them both laugh. Hearing her co-workers mention the upcoming ceremony reminded her that Abe would be assigned this time. He would move to a dwelling, have a set of parents and perhaps an older sibling. She would have to find a new way of continuing their relationship. Of course, his new female parent, Claire could not make herself think mother, would have a job in the community as all women did, so the child would go to the child care center each day. Claire had done volunteer work there when she was young and fulfilling her required hours. She had enjoyed that time and knew that Abe would be well cared for there. He would be given educational toys, fed a balanced diet fortified with vitamins, taken for walks in the big multi-child stroller, and introduced to basic discipline. The meaning of no and don't, how he must not suck his thumb, though he would be permitted to stroke his comfort object if he needed soothing. He would be tucked into a crib at nap time, when the big room's lights were dimmed. Thinking of the nap time ritual, Claire felt a little concerned. Abe still was not a good sleeper. Most toddlers in the child care center responded to firm discipline and learned quickly to be silent when the lights were dimmed. She remembered the rows of cribs with most of the little occupants sound asleep and those who were wakeful staring quietly at the ceiling. The small children had names by then, and she recalled walking along the row and reading Liam, Svetlana, Barbara, Henrik on the identifying cards. Soon, after the upcoming ceremony, he would be officially Abe. She desperately hoped that the crib with his name on it would not contain a wailing, sleepless little boy who would toss his hippo to the floor and thump his feet rhythmically against the mattress, shrieking and kicking, sometimes holding his breath until his face turned frighteningly dark, was what he was still doing at the nurturing center at nap time. Whatever would they do with such a child when he entered the child care system? Failure to thrive, they wrote on his chart when he was very young. Now? Failure to adjust? She shuddered. There were very severe consequences in the community for a citizen who couldn't adjust. Surely they would be more lenient with a very small boy, Claire thought. But she wasn't certain. It made her nervous to think about it. She rode over to visit one afternoon, 2 days before the ceremony, and could see the cleanup crews working hard outside the auditorium, obviously preparing for the one time each year when the entire community gathered. Claire would attend this year. Already they had assigned a different worker to remain at the hatchery. It was important to her to see Abe assigned, to know where he would be next. Maybe since the assignments were so close, she could sneak a look at the paperwork. Sometimes there was a clipboard on the nurturer's desk. Perhaps the information was there. But when Claire arrived at the nurturing center, she could feel immediately that something was wrong.
Of course, she thought, they are all very busy because of the ceremony plans. They have to prepare these children, all 50, for new families. A letter would have to accompany each new child, a letter with instructions for the parental unit, feeding information, schedules, discipline reminders, health data, and observations about personality. Of course the staff was preoccupied and distracted. It accounted, Claire thought, for the heightened tension she felt. The nurturer, who had always been so pleasant to her, the one with a son named Jonas who took Abe to his dwelling at night, was oddly abrupt when she greeted him. He seemed angry. She could hear a muttered argument taking place in a corner. No one smiled at her. Even more distressingly, when she went to pick up Abe, who was playing with a wooden toy on the floor, someone snatched him away.
"Not a good idea to play with this one," a uniformed female worker said. "There's one over there, that girl. She needs to be changed. You could do that if you want to be helpful."
The woman stalked off, holding Abe. She plopped him into an empty crib, and he began to howl immediately. Everyone ignored him.
"I could maybe quiet him down," Claire suggested, "and you'd be able to get your work done more easily."
"Leave him," the woman commanded her.
Claire looked questioningly at the nurturer, whom she had begun to think of as a friend. She realized suddenly that in all these months, she had never asked his name. But clearly now was not the time. His face was set in hard lines and he looked away.
"But I said, leave him," the woman repeated impatiently.
Claire wanted to argue, perceived that she must not, and fell silent. Dutifully, she picked up the baby girl they had indicated and took her to the changing table. In the background, Abe screamed and kicked at the bars of the crib. No one moved toward him. Claire cleaned and diapered the cheerful female and set her back down with her toys on the floor. Other babies crawled and played nonchalantly, as if they were accustomed to the shrieking boy in the crib. At the desk, the nurturer, whose name she had never thought to learn, the one who Claire knew cared about Abe, suddenly slammed shut the reader-writer device he'd been working on. He stood. He looked at the clock on the wall.
"I'm leaving early," he said.
"Excuse me?"
The uniformed woman looked up. She seemed to have some authority.
"I have a headache," the nurturer said.
The woman glanced at the communication system on the wall.
"You can call for medication," she pointed out.
The nurturer ignored her. He went over to the crib and picked up Abe, who was clutching his comfort object and still shuddering with sobs, though his shrieking had subsided. "I'll take him with me now. You know he spends the nights in my dwelling."
"No need," she said sharply. "He might as well stay here tonight. What's the point?"
"The point is that my family is fond of him, and I would like to have him with us this evening." He was speaking firmly to her, and Claire could see that she was trying to decide whether to argue.
When she turned back to the papers in her hands, it was clear that she had decided against any confrontation.
"Return him early tomorrow," she said. It sounded like an order.
"I will." He walked toward the door, the toddler in his arms, and then spoke to Claire.
"Do you have your bike?
Why don't you ride partway with us? You can turn off to the hatchery at the main road." Confused, Claire nodded to the woman, who ignored her, and followed the man and Abe. She waited to watch him pack the hippo into the carrying case, then strap the child into the bike seat, then mounted her own bicycle and rode beside him on the path. He didn't speak. The baby glanced at her, smiling now. She lifted one hand from the handle grip, waved to him, and watched him wave back. Both bikes slowed at the intersection where Claire would turn to the right. They stopped.
"Maybe I'll see you tomorrow," she said uncertainly.
"I know you have a lot of work because of the ceremony, but..." He interrupted her. "I know you didn't attend last year," he said. "Do you plan to go to this one?"
Claire nodded.
"I especially want to see Abe get his assigned family."
The man hesitated, then told her.
"They're not assigning him. And no more extensions either. They've run out of patience with him. They voted today."
Behind him, the child began to churn his legs. He wanted the bike to start up again.
"But what then? Where will he?"
The man shrugged.
"You should say goodbye now. He'll be sent on his way in the morning."
On his way where?
The child had heard the word goodbye. He opened and closed his chubby hand toward Claire.
Bye-bye, he said. Bye-bye.
Then he thrust his tongue into his cheek and made their secret funny face with its creased forehead and wrinkled nose.
Claire tried hard to make the face back to him, but it was difficult. She was breathing hard and could feel tears rising hotly behind her eyes. Where? She asked again. But the man simply shook his head. It seemed to Claire that he was unable to speak, that his breath was coming quickly as well.
Then he gathered himself and said offhandedly, It's just the way it is. It's for the best. It's the way the system works. And by the way, you have his name wrong. It's not Abe. Ready, little guy? He asked, swiveling his head to check on his passenger. Off we go.
As he started forward, some pebbles spat from the path and stung Claire's ankle. Stunned, she watched the bicycle set off across the path that led to the family dwellings. Years later, many years later, when Claire tried to piece together memories of her last days in the community, the last thing she could see whole and clear were the bicycle moving away and the back of the child's head. The rest of the hours that followed were fragments, like bits of shattered glass. No matter how hard she tried to piece them together, she could never create it whole and unblemished. She remembered that the cargo boat was still docked. It was loading. They were rushing for some reason. She heard someone call to another about weather concerns, a phrase she didn't understand. There were the usual complicated sounds of the departure preparations, whistles and shouts, the thump of the crates being stacked. But then night came and went, and the boat had not left. Something had happened in the night. There were alarm bells. In the hatchery? Something wrong in the lab? No, not there. The boat? Were the alarms from the boat? No, from farther away, from the main building, and from the speakers in each room. Loud announcements, waking everyone. But why? What had gone wrong? It was morning now in her memory. The boat crew had been preparing to cast off the ropes and leave, but they were delayed. Time had passed. Usually the boat was there so briefly, but this time it was longer. Something delayed the boat's departure. Everyone was looking for something. Someone? Yes, it was that. Someone was missing. Searchers came and looked along the riverbank throughout the day. Then it was dark again. Even at night they searched with flashlights. They shouted. She remembered, strangely, that the nurturer had been standing on the path. Why was he there? She had never seen him there before. Now he stood there but didn't acknowledge Claire, didn't look at her. He was looking at the river. He was calling a name. Jonas! Jonas! His son. Yes, that was his son. So it was his son who had gone missing. Piecing together the fragments of memory, Claire could feel the cool dirt of the path under her bare feet. Why would she have been barefoot? Everyone always wore shoes. And running. Why had she been running? Now the nurturer spoke to her loudly. But what had he said?
He took him. Jonas took the babe.
Was that what he had shouted to her?
Elsewhere. Elsewhere.
But what did that mean? Then, through the blurred confusion of the memory, she found that she was on the boat. She had run up the slanted plank in her bare feet, crying. The heavyset woman, her light hair unpinned, came from the cabin and put out her arms to Claire. She remembered the feeling of enfolding. The smells. Sweat and onions from the woman, fuel and damp wood from the boat itself, a puff of smoke, the scrape of the plank being pulled aboard. She was with them, on the boat. The engine throbbed, they were leaving. Why was she, Claire, on the boat? They were headed elsewhere. They said they would help her find the boy and the baby.
My son, she had told them, sobbing.
Her next blurred memory was of sea, which she had never seen before. Rain, something she had never felt. Storm, lightning, waves, fear. The men were shouting. She was in the way. They shoved her aside and rushed to tie things down. She couldn't stand. It was wet and slippery, even inside the cabin. She fell, sprawled on the floor. She heard things slide loose and break. She felt a rush of water suddenly. It pulled at her clothing. Cold, so cold. And then, quiet. A hollow, rushing kind of quiet. Darkness. And that was all Claire remembered of those last days, no matter how hard she tried over the hard and lonely years that followed. Book 2. Between. Chapter 1. The slate-gray sea roiled, scraping the narrow strip of sand rhythmically, tugging at beach grass, digging and sucking loose the rocks at the shore's edge. Spray stung the men's eyes when they went to tighten the ropes holding their boat secure. Salt coated their beards and eyebrows. They pulled their woven hat brims low. Old Benedict cupped his hand over his eyes and peered upward, assessing the sky through the pelting rain. "It won't break for a while," he called. "Not till night." But his words were carried off by the stiff wind, and the others, tugging and twisting at the coarse ropes, didn't hear him, didn't reply. The women remained in their cottages. Fighting the weather was men's work. The women listened to the wind as it roared in the chimneys, to the ripping sounds of torn thatch, and to the whimpering of frightened children. They tended the fires, stirred the soups, rocked the babies, and waited. This storm would pass. The sea would calm. It always had. In the time that came after, the story of Water Claire took different forms. It was told and retold. Things were forgotten or shaped and changed. Always, though, there was this truth, that she came from the sea, flung in by that fearsome December storm years before. Some said she was found later, when the scudding clouds pulled aside and showed low sun in early evening, that she was there on the strip of beach, her clothes half torn from her, and they thought she was dead, till she stirred and her eyes opened to show the deep amber-flecked green that later all remembered the same. Others said no, it was tall Andrus who saw her in the waves, who threw himself in and grabbed her by her long hair as she clung to a thick wood beam, that he swam with her till he could stand, and when they looked he was there in the churning broth of sea with her in his thick arms, her head against his beard, and that he said but one word, "Mine." Children said she was carried in by dolphins, and they made games of it and rhymes. But all of that was just tail-spinning and fun, and no one took it to be true. Others murmured Selkie from time to time when she was remembered, but only as a fanciful tale. The Selkie stories of seal creatures were well-known, oft-told, and in all of them there was a shed skin. Water Claire had come in clothing, though it had been shredded by the gritty winter sea. She was human. There was no seal to her. Or mermaid either. She was a human girl sent to them by the sea, who stayed among them for a time, became a woman, and went away again. It was actually Old Benedict himself who carried her in once she was seen. Several, including tall Andrus, swam out, but it was Old Benedict who reached her first, slicing his way through waves with his burly, muscled arms. He pried her loose from the wood spar, for her fingers were locked there. He knew how to wrap her lifeless arms around his neck and to hold her pale chin high above the foam and spray. He had brought wounded sheep in from the field this way many times, holding them against his chest. He stood, finally, in the shallow surge and suck of water, walked forward, his feet heavy in the drenched, icy sand, and laid her there. He could see that she still lived, and he covered her with the thick woven coat that he had thrown aside as he entered the sea. Then he turned her wet, pale face to the side, he pressed upon her through the coat until she spewed frothy brine onto the sand and coughed. Tall Andrus was there, it is true, and he thought, gazing down, that he wanted the girl for his own, but did not give voice to it. Old Benedict looked up at the surrounding men. "Run ahead," he directed Gavin, who was fastest. "Tell Elise, we'll carry her there." Hastily the men gathered poles and coats and made a carrying litter, knowing how to do it, for they had done it many times before. Their children fell from boats and cliffs, their sons and brothers were wounded by hooks and rope, their women died giving birth, and the newborns died too. They used such a litter for the slow journey to Graveside. But this girl was alive, though her eyes stayed closed and her fingers clenched, as if she still felt the splintery mast in them. When they rolled her onto the litter, she coughed again, and when they lifted it to carry her up the hill, a cold breeze picked up a strand of her long wet hair, drawing it across her cheek. Her eyelashes fluttered then, and she began to tremble and whimper. Carefully, in the increasing darkness, for twilight was brief here in winter, they moved her up the ridge and felt with their feet for the worn path that would take them to the village and to Elise's hut at its edge. Four men carried the girl. The others walked behind. Now and then one stopped, turned, and looked out toward the sea and the horizon with its darkening sky, as if searching for the silhouette of a vessel that might have thrown this astonishing gift their way. But there was nothing there, but what had always been there. Empty ocean the color of pewter, tarnishing to black now as night fell. The village nestled at the foot of a forbidding cliff in the curved elbow of an arm of land. The peninsula jutted out from the main coast in an isolated place where time didn't matter, for nothing changed. No newcomers had ever appeared, not in anyone's memory, and only an occasional discontented man climbed out, for that was what they called the leaving, or tried to. An overgrown root-tangled path meandered upward at the foot of the cliff, but then disappeared at the base of a sheer rock wall, and after that, there was no way to go farther but to climb. Several had fallen to their death. One, fierce Einar, had climbed out successfully but returned, embittered by what he had encountered at the top. He had quarreled with his father and climbed out on a winter night with a sack of his own belongings and some he had stolen, tied to his back. When he returned, climbing back in, it almost killed him, for he was maimed by then, bloody and in terrible pain. He dropped from the final rocks onto the snowy path at the base, howling in agony and with a knowledge of failure. Then he fell silent. He crawled to a place where he could pull down a narrow tree. He stripped it of branches, broke the trunk into two pieces, and used them to haul himself upright. Then he leaned on the sticks and dragged himself home to face his father. He lost the title Fierce and was renamed Lame Einar. Still only 18, still silent, he tended sheep now and nursed a deep despair. The best route away from the village was by sea, but the ocean was turbulent and unpredictable, with dangerous currents and constant wind. Each fisherman had found himself in peril more than once, and all had lost friends or brothers. Elise, toothless and wrinkled, though with piercing eyes and a sharp tongue, told the men roughly, "Leave us be," when they carried the trembling creature into her. She tended the girl through the night. Elise was childless herself, but had been midwife to many and was no stranger to damaged young. She stripped the girl of the drenched, ripped clothing, setting it aside, then rubbed her dry with rough cloth and wrapped her in soft wool. She did all this in the flickering light from a smoky oil lamp. When the girl stopped shaking, Elise stirred the herb-flavored broth that had been simmering on the fire in an iron pot. She poured some into a bowl and fed the girl from a spoon held carefully, lest she thrust it away in her fear. But the girl sipped, wary at first, then opened her mouth for more. "Go slow or you'll puke," Elise told her.
"What brung you?"
she asked when the soup bowl was emptied. The girl's head turned, and she half rose, listening to the murmur of the sea. But she did not answer, and the old woman did not urge her. Instead, Elise found a comb carved of bone on the shelf nearby and began to unsnarl and smooth the wet, salt-stiffened hair. The wind howled through the thatch on the roof. It was deepest right now. The girl dozed, half-sitting. Finally, Elise lowered her to the bed and pulled the length of wool cloth up around her bare shoulders. She watched for a few moments as the girl slept, her hair fanned about her head. Elise had always yearned for a daughter, and felt that the sea had sent this one to her. After a bit, she lowered the flame in the lamp so that the hut was dim, with dark shadows on its walls. She wrapped her own self in a woven blanket, sank into a nearby chair, and slept too. In the morning, the girl woke and wept softly. When she saw her clothing, all rags now encrusted with drying salt, she clutched the tatters, feeling the ruined cloth with her fingers, and then relinquished it all, turning her face to the wall. After a bit, with a resigned sigh, she took the coarse woven shift that Elise offered her, slipped it over her head, and stood. Her bare legs and arms were bruised and scraped. One ankle was badly swollen, and she favored it, limping to the table where Elise had set a bowl of porridge. Her hair was red-gold burnished copper in the early light of winter that came through the small window and fell over her as she ate. The day was fair, as it was often after storms.
"What brung you to this place?" Elise asked her again. "What carried you and threw you to the storm?"
But again the girl did not answer, though she stared at Elise with her gold-flecked eyes. She had a puzzled look.
"Do you not understand our tongue?" Elise asked,
knowing that the question was foolish, for if the answer were to be no, then the girl could not understand in order to give it.
"I am Elise," the old woman pointed to herself. "Elise," she said again, and patted her own chest in explanation. "I have no child, none ever. But I have birthed many among our women, and few died in the birthing. They say I have the firm hands and the feel for it, and also I lay out the dead and sometimes can heal if the sickness is not beyond healing. That's why they brung you to me, for they felt you needed healing, or, if not healing, then I would clean and wrap you for the grave."
The girl was watching her. Her bowl was empty, and she raised the cup of milk beside it and drank deeply. From outside they could hear suddenly the giggles of children. Elise pushed a window open, peered out, and called to them.
"She's alive! She eats and is whole with no parts broken. Go and tell, and stay off now till she's rested good. She don't need the likes of you laughing and shouting about."
"What be her name?"
a child's voice called.
"Go now, we'll know her name soon enough. Or give her one," the woman called.
And then there was the sound of the little one scampering away. With her gnarled hand, she smoothed the girl's hair.
"It's just the curiosity comes on them. Them three little ones are always together, best friends they are. Delwith, Bethan, and Era be their names. I midwifed each one, same year. 6 they are, and full of the mischief, but they have good hearts and mean no harm."
Then the girl spoke.
"My name is Claire," she said.
Chapter 2 They called her Water Claire. People came to Elise's hut during the weeks that passed and brought gifts to Claire, knowing she had nothing of her own. They were a generous people as a rule. Gareth, his bald head and round cheeks pink with shyness, made shoes for her, leather sandals with straps that she fastened around her ankles, over thick knitted socks, when the swelling lessened.